Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, we're recording on Monday morning. So this was the apoplectic weekend for Arnie Arneson. Why? Because she learned that NBC signed a $300,000 contract with Rona Romney McDaniel. Does that name sound familiar? Well, that's because she used to be the head of the RNC. She even took the name Romney out of her name just to make Donald Trump a happy camper. She did everything to promote the lie. She is just, but she wasn't MAGA enough, I guess. Maybe it was just that he just wanted to control someone in the family who would then make sure all the money coming into the RNC would be siphoned to him so he could pay off his legal bills. But for whatever reason, Rona did everything except, well, she actually did kiss his butt in order to stay, but unfortunately she did not. And then who turned out before the smell and stench of MAGA had left her, but NBC decided to hire her as a contributor at $300,000. So I was furious. This morning I did something which was kind of interesting. I went back and forth between CNN and MSNBC on the early morning show. What I should tell you that happened on CNN when I had CNN on, they spent an entire half hour talking about NBC's decision to hire Rona. It was hilarious. It was hilarious. And then I saw a few minutes on MSNBC, but nothing great. So please forgive me, but I'm going to take a read from Politico, because Politico filled in some of the gaps in a lot of the misinformation and disinformation about what happened on Meet the Press and on NBC. It was entitled Meet the Mess, is what it was entitled. Moments ago, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski became the latest voices on NBC Universal to criticize the company's hiring of former RNC chair Rona McDaniel as a paid contributor. Quote, "We weren't asked our opinion of the hiring, but if we were, we would have strongly objected to it for several reasons." Anyway, that's typical Joe. In other words, he said something and now he can move on. These comments came a day after Chuck Todd pilloried NBC executives moments after McDaniel's first network appearance and interview with Kristen Welker on Meet the Press. Quote, "I think our bosses owe you an apology for putting you in this situation," Todd told Welker. "There's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting and have been met with character assassination. And he goes on and on and on, and there's been a lot of, you know, protests about this moment. And they claim that the relationship was forged last year when they were wooing the RNC to set up these Republican presidential debates, of which I don't think there were any. And though they built this sort of interesting relationship, it turns out that NBC News executive, senior vice president of politics, and the president of editorial, after McDaniel left the RNC, they were competing, they claim, with other groups like ABC to hire her, but she ultimately decided to go with NBC. Now, this is part of the story. The McDaniel deal was unanimously, let me repeat that word, unanimously supported by leaders of all their networks at NBC. Can I repeat that sentence? The McDaniel deal was unanimously supported by leaders of all their networks, a knowledgeable person at NBC told us, including Rashida Jones, president of MSNBC. The internal backlash began on Friday morning after Butoff Brown sent in an email announcing that she would appear across all NBC News platforms. Well, that was the arrangement. And then all of a sudden, Rashida Jones goes, "Oh, no, no, I never said MSNBC. Well, somebody's lying, my friends. And I just want everyone to know, this feels so much like, again, we're being sold out. This is going to be such a tough election in 2024. The places where we can go for the facts and the truth are getting harder. The first day that Rona was on Meet the Press, she lied. She lied. She is a serial liar, and she lied on Meet the Press when she said that she needed to remain neutral during the primary for the Republican nominee for president. That is not true. I actually linked to a YouTube where Rona was asking Nikki Haley to step aside. So the word neutral is a lie coming out of her mouth. So I just want everyone to know, and now to have NBC do this, it makes me want to vomit. And then last but not least, and I will turn to my guest from Salon.com, and that is, I used to be a fellow at Harvard. In 2017, I was at a breakfast at Harvard at the Kennedy School, and it was hours after it was announced that Corey Lewandowski and Sean Spicer had been given a fellowship at the Kennedy School. I went freaking apoplectic. I went, they're liars. They make crap up. They're Holocaust deniers and they're misogynists. This is a role model for your students. And trust me, I looked at the head of the Kennedy School. I said, what the H are you doing? So I'm just going to tell you right now, our institutions are failing us. Whether it's NBC or whether it's Harvard, it makes me want to Rolf. And on that note, let me go to my first guest. We've had her on before, and she is covering something that I think we can't talk about enough. And what she writes about is Project 2025. She has a Substack entitled How Project 2025 Will Ruin Your Life. Actually, I hate to break it to Andra, it will destroy the country and probably the planet. So it's not just your life. It's much bigger than that. Andra Watkins is a best-selling author who lives in Charleston, South Carolina. She writes at Substack, How Project 2025 Will Ruin Your Life. You can follow her on LinkedIn. This is her second piece that she has written now at Salon.com. Her first piece, the one that we interviewed her for a couple weeks ago, was entitled, Project 2025 is more than a playbook for Trumpism. It's the Christian Nationalist Manifesto. She continues along that theme with her more recent piece, Decoding Project 2025's Christian Nationalist Language. Evangelical Lise allows Trump's MAGA supporters to hide their extreme positions in plain sight. So let me welcome Andra back to the program. Thank you so much for doing this, Andra. And frankly, I'm almost going to be doing Project 2025, if not every week, every other week, because I think that talking about Donald Trump, frankly, is a distraction. Because Donald Trump is, he's the fig leaf. He's the figurehead. He's intentionally the distraction. And what people don't want to know is that what comes out of Trump's mouth is not the agenda for if he gets elected. The agenda, if Trump gets elected, is written in Project 2025. So not only let me welcome you back to the program, but again, remind my audience a little bit about this thing called Project 2025, its relationship to the Heritage Foundation, and why we should read it and know everything about it and understand what it would mean for the America that we claim to love now that will be transformed if it gets put into place.
Project 2025 is what I call a Christo-fascist manifesto. It's 920 pages. It was put together by the Heritage Foundation with the support of over 100 organizations who are affiliated with them in some way, and they're all far-right, extreme, many of them Christian nationalist organizations. So it's very alarming to read the document and see how much Christian nationalist language is embedded within it. And I started breaking that down for readers so they could understand what that meant.
And remind my audience again, Andra, a little bit about why you are well qualified to do this. I mean, you're a New York Times bestseller, but that doesn't mean anything, because what you do as you were looking at this document is not looking at it as a New York Times bestseller. You are looking at it as a someone who has a history in this idea of Christian nationalism, of this extreme evangelicalism. So I want people to understand that the Andra we are talking today understands the code because you were raised in the code.
Yes, I spent 13 years in Christian nationalist church and schools growing up. My church was affiliated with the moral majority, and I attended Liberty University my freshman year of college, and they're one of the sponsors of Project 2025. So I have a lot of background in that world, and I'm grateful to be out of it, but happy to help people understand it.
You know what sort of upsets me, Andra, is that I've been doing talk radio since 1988, but I've been doing talk radio nationally probably sometime since the late 1990s and 2000s. I would go down to Washington, D.C. to cover congressional events or political events, and you know where I would do my show from? The Heritage Foundation. They would offer me a microphone. They would offer me an office. They would give me coffee. They would do, and now, and Arnie's a lefty. Okay, I'm going to admit it. You know, I'm definitely a progressive, and they knew who I was, but they weren't crazy back then. I mean, I knew a lot of people that had a connection to the Heritage Foundation. What I am looking at coming out of the Heritage Foundation in 2024 is the Heritage Foundation I could not recognize. And so I am just sort of curious, because in a lot of ways, they actually have cover, because there are a lot of people like myself who have this old historical relationship with the Heritage Foundation, which always used to be very conservative, but it wasn't like crazy Christian nationalist conservative. So I'm kind of curious, can you give me a little bit of a sense of the morphing of this institution, and that now it has become a vehicle for this really extreme fascist Christian nationalist agenda. It's not just Christian nationalism, everyone. It's fascist. It is, and not to include the word fascist is to dull its potential, because its potential is much greater, because they don't believe in elections. They don't believe in results. They don't believe in law unless they write it and they win. Well, that's not democracy, that's fascism. So as you've been writing this, I'm kind of curious about, like, what's changed at the Heritage Foundation, and how are they so clearly a vehicle, and they actually are now celebrating the kind of stuff that's coming out from them, where 25 years ago, this wouldn't pass the smell test.
Okay. So they wrote the first version of what now is Project 2025 in 1979. They got together at the Heritage Foundation and said, we need some kind of document, some kind of roadmap, so that we can have more conservatives in government. Okay. And they gave that document to Ronald Reagan, and Reagan implemented about half of their policy recommendations during his first administration. So every 4 years, they have been producing a version of this document. And depending upon who was president, either none of it got implemented or some of it got implemented. In 2016, Donald Trump became enamored of the document and implemented over 60% of its policy recommendations. But every time they would do a version of it, they would move more to the right as things got implemented. You know, this is what we think we can get implemented this time. And so they'd get what they could, and then they'd move further to the right. So that's how the Heritage Foundation has marched further and further to the right over the course of this vast amount of time.
You mentioned that Donald Trump got enamored with it. Donald Trump doesn't get enamored with policy, but the people around him get enamored with policy. And then they sell it to the chief. You know, they're like, exactly. Oh, you're going to like this. I mean, if I'm thinking about this, as I'm hearing about Project 2025 and the Heritage Foundation and what they did, you know, 4 years before with the other project that they developed, is that, you know, you keep saying they keep building on what they did. I would love to have someone do like graph paper and a timeline of what they did in the 1970s and what Reagan embraced, what they did in the 1980s, and then what was embraced by Bush, and then what they did, and so that we could begin to see that they've been so brilliant at building and being methodical. They don't see losing as a loss. They see the 60% as a win. They see 20% as a win. Because they know exactly that roadmap that you were talking about, and then they build on each of the wins.
The only difference with Project 2025, in my view, is they see this as the last stand. They see this as an all or nothing. They say
now,
that.
How come they see this as the last stand? What is this that gives it its sense of finality? Is it that this is the document that basically puts the knife in the back of democracy, and therefore they're not going to need another Project 2020, whatever, because they will have accomplished their task, because now they've gotten to goal.
That's what I believe, yes.
And describe for my audience what goal is. So I want them to know that this is the seal of the Project 2025 profit. This is the end, okay? So tell me, what does the end look like? So I realize that I am not voting for Trump or Biden. I'm voting for Project 2025 or Biden. That's what I'm voting for. And Trump, in some ways, is a distraction, because you don't know what he thinks, and he changes it every hour. And all he wants to do is like bitch and moan about how I'm there for you and I'm your revenge. I don't want to know about his revenge. I want to know about this document. So what in this document should terrify every American, blue, red, urban, rural, rich or poor, because they will be found and getting screwed?
We don't have enough time to cover all that, but in a short nutshell.
Okay.
Project 2025 will turn our democracy into a Christo-fascist regime.
And what does that mean?
It means that this version of Christian nationalism that believes America was founded as a Christian nation, a white Christian nation, and that our laws should be drawn from the Bible and their interpretation of it, will govern every aspect of American life and will impact every American.
So you mentioned a couple of things. You have a section called On Pornography. and that you write pornography should be outlawed. Now, I'm not a big celebrant of pornography, although, you know, but what scares me is what do they mean by pornography? Because they use the term, and then we each have this sort of image, you know, in our head of what they mean. My fear is their interpretation of pornography doesn't even come close to what I'm imagining.
It doesn't. They think, you know, book bans are, a lot of those are because of pornography that they see in them. Love scenes or sex scenes in books can be pornography to them, especially if the characters aren't married. To some parents in Florida, this Michelangelo's David was pornography because it was a naked statue. Some school districts in Florida are putting clothes on characters in children's books because anything that isn't clothed enough is deemed pornography to them. So there's a lot of things that they consider pornography. Mike Johnson is on the record as saying all homosexuality is pornography. There's an Oklahoma senator who said transgenderism was filth, which is another code word for pornography. So is sex advice pornography? Is reading a racy trash romance novel pornography? To them, it would be. It would all be pornography. Most of us would be pornographers under their definition of pornography.
Well, not only would most of us be pornography, but I want to connect it to something that really personally infuriates me. And that is what's happening now with the assault on abortion and the assault on IVF. And the assault on birth control. Because guess what? They're going to be able to connect that to pornography. And I have a sentence in front of me that I'm going to share with you, Andra, but this doesn't surprise you because you know this as well. The Comstock Act is a federal law that authorized the post office to search mail for any obscene, lewd, lascivious, indecent, filthy, or vile article, matter, thing, device, or substance. Okay? Now, I'm thinking pornography. Well, this does include pornography as you and I think of pornography. But if you are a writer of Project 2025 and you are defining pornography, you include in that pornography information or items related to sexual health, sexuality, abortion, and birth control. And that means if I send you mifepristone, if I send you birth control through the mail, if I send you a condom through the mail, if I send you anything dealing with, you know, a sex act through the mail, they can do it. And the problem is we just did an interview, Andra, that we're going to be talking about the post office and about the assault on the post office. But not only is there an assault on the post office, but they can actually put your mail through this descriptor where they can see what's inside your mail. So understand that if they're going to go after your birth control, they're going to claim that it's pornography. They're going to put this and implement this agenda through Project 2025. I mean, women, where are you? You are nothing more than basically sex slaves because they are going to decide every aspect of your life, every aspect of your life. And there'll be very little that you can do, which is why I needed to ask you about pornography, because it's not pornography. It's everything dealing with your body. And that's what's so terrifying. So pornography is one place that they're going to go. Where else are they going to go?
They have very biblical definitions of marriage. It's between one man and one unrelated woman. And they draw that from a verse in Genesis in the Bible. And they apply that definition also to the family. So Their policy recommendations really put in place a limit on who qualifies for help. They want most welfare to be administered by faith-based organizations. They mention faith-based organizations, churches, religious groups 130 times in this document and recommend that different types of welfare be distributed by those groups, which means if you're a woman who's been forced to have a baby that you could not afford and you go for help, you have to go to Bible study to get diapers for your baby, or you have to attend a church service to get food stamps, or you have to meet with an unqualified Christian counselor who's going to read the Bible with you as a means of therapy to qualify for housing or clothing. That's how those kinds of groups work. It's religious indoctrination for welfare assistance. And Project 2025 is very high on it.
Okay, so I got two concerns. One is that they don't want you to have an abortion. You may have a baby that you can't afford, or you may in fact not have a spouse. Now, there are two couple of things. We talk about divorce, and they not only look at one man and one woman, but they now look at, they want to repeal no-fault divorce. That's a negative. And they basically sort of have this idea that even if you're in a toxic, bad, harmful marriage, you have an obligation to stay. And I think that's the other thing, is that there is no way of getting out. Once you've gotten in, they want to like slam the door behind you. So between what you're telling me about welfare, what you're telling me about pornography and birth control, what you're telling me about divorce, they want to go back to a time where women have no rights and women are basically vehicles to serve men. But as I'm reading Project 2025, what do they say about the obligation of men? Do they mention that at all? Or is that just an assumed?
Well, they talk about how men are the standard breadwinners. They actually use that language in the document, that it's a man's job to be the breadwinner, to provide for his family, to provide playful support while the mother provides, you know, the emotional support and the nurturing and the emotional labor of motherhood. So that's what men are required to do in this arrangement. Women are required to be subservient, to stay home, to submit to their husbands, to rear their children. And they basically outline that also. In one section that I haven't covered yet, they propose that instead of giving credits for childcare for women to work outside the home, that the government pay money to couples so that one spouse, it will be the woman, will stay home and rear their own children.
So I'm going to push back on that. I'm not offended by that. They actually do that in Norway and Sweden. Okay. So what's so interesting to me is that when the Norwegians and the Swedes do it, it's socialism, because they don't also tie women to the bed. Okay. Exactly. And they also allow women to have, so it's so interesting because there's a piece of me that says that's a good thing. If you want to stay home, if you want, you can't. There's just no way. We don't have parental leave. We don't have any of these things. But the issue, the interesting aspect of it is, why do they want to pay these women to stay home? Because they want them to be in the home. And as we look at Project 2025, is there anything about how the economy will survive after they do this? Because right now we can't find enough workers. We can't fund, I mean, if you go to any farm, most of the folks that are working there are probably undocumented. If you go to any meatpacking plant, most of the folks that are doing that are probably undocumented. If you go into a lot of places that, you know, even do some infrastructure in America, a number of folks are, I'm just trying to figure out, and then you go into a bank and they're all female. I'm just trying to figure out, how do the banks operate? How do we fix our infrastructure? How do we do anything if virtually half the population is being relegated back to the house?
They don't address that. I am covering some of their tax proposals this week, though, on my Substack. And of course, they are big tax breaks for billionaires and millionaires and corporations. And they have tax increases on the middle class and the upper middle class and the lower class. And that's what they're proposing across the board, saying that it's the best thing for you and me.
So they actually embrace the trickle-down theory. That if
yes.
we give billionaires, if we give billionaires enough money, it'll eventually trickle down. We just found something out the other day that 90% of the profit that was made in 2022 to 2023, 90% of that profit, it went to stockholders. Mm-hmm. Okay. It didn't go to employees. It didn't go to, you know, capital improvements. It went to stockholders. So mm-hmm. we kind of know what that means. That's the kind of the code that we're seeing as we talk about this. I think what's shocking is how many members of Congress have taken Project 2025 and are running on it in November of 2024. Do we see a connect the dots, not just between perhaps Donald Trump, which we're not quite sure what he embraces, but more importantly, what U.S. senators and members of Congress are now embracing? Because are people using this document and then turning to Republicans and saying, is this what you want? Is this what
they're
you believe?
They're already using it. They're already right. using it at the state level. This is Florida. This is Texas. This is Idaho. This is Oklahoma. This is any red state. They're already implementing it in so many states because they have a tactical document behind this thing too. That's not public. So we can see what their tactics are going to be by what many red states are already doing to create Christo-fascist governments.
Andrea Watkins writes for Salon.com. She has a Substack that's entitled How Project 2025 Will Ruin Your Life. She ends her piece at Salon.com this way. Orwell understood that the manipulation of language is an insidious tool of autocracies. Christian nationalists have been working for decades to pollute the discourse as a means to power and control. The future of American democracy depends upon understanding what Christian nationalists mean when they say things. It is vital to drill down into their doublespeak, or we may find ourselves living in a dystopian reality created in the image of their Christian nationalist faith. Thank you so much for joining me, Andra. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. It is difficult to think of a worse leader at this moment for Israel than Bibi Netanyahu. It was his poor leadership and decision-making and the coalition he assembled that frankly contributed to allowing the horrors of October 7th to happen. Since then, he has conducted this war with a singular focus on his political survival rather than what is best for the state of Israel. Now, Netanyahu seems to be taking a page from Vladimir Putin's playbook and putting his political future in the hands of the American electorate and doing whatever he can to hope that Donald Trump gets back in office and then lets him kind of do whatever he wants. We saw this just the other day when Prime Minister Netanyahu canceled his trip to the United States to meet with President Biden. If you are the leader of Israel, the one bilateral relationship that you can never jeopardize is that with the United States. The United States is by far the most important political relationship that Israel has and is in many respects Israel's patron. Moreover, Joe Biden personally is a friend of Israel and not insignificantly a friend of the Jewish people going back well over half a century. Anybody who questions Biden's support for Israel and his understanding of Israel as an important relationship for the United States is living in a fantasy world. Biden is about as good a friend of Israel as any Israeli or any Israeli prime minister could hope for. Many have criticized Biden for being too supportive of Israel, and Netanyahu has now managed to alienate Biden, and he has done it because he believes it is in his political interest to do that, because maybe, just maybe, in Netanyahu's world, this rift will bring Trump back, and that will make Netanyahu's political future stronger. At this critical moment in the history of the state of Israel, and indeed of the Jewish people, the state of Israel deserves a lot better leadership than what it's getting. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute, or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We record on Monday morning. So my good friend Dave Leventhal, who's the editor-in-chief at Raw Story, said, you've got to look at this story about the U.S. Post Office. And I'll be honest with you, I'm like, I got so much on my plate, David. What are you doing? He goes, just do me a favor. Look at the story. So I looked at the story and I went, oh my God, this is one of the most detailed, informative stories I've read in a long time. It explains a lot. A number of members of Congress, both in the U.S. Senate and the House, have stepped up, I think in part because of her fabulous investigative work. But I do need to explain to my guest, Alexandria Jacobson, investigative reporter at Raw Story, when I posted your piece on my Facebook page, I got 60, 70 comments within a day, less than a day. And everybody had such an amazing response. And two of my close friends have been postmistresses and they said, don't even get us started. So it was like an applause-o-meter for you. So thank you so much for doing this, for making me more familiar with something I was sort of aware of, but not necessarily completely aware of. And before I let you begin with this really remarkable investigative story, I told you that, you know, in a lot of ways, the idea of the U.S. Post Office is very important to me. My friends were very involved in the post office, but I actually named my first daughter after the postmaster of Pittsford, Vermont. I met him when he was in his late 80s. He had already retired. He was spending most of his time in a nursing home. He was the most beloved person you could ever imagine in that community. But Mr. Dennison never had children. And when I met him, I was in my early 20s, you know, late teens. And I loved him. I just, and he'd been a fresh air father where he would bring kids up from Brooklyn and bring them to Pittsburgh. I mean, he was the essence of everything good. And I said to him, Mr. Dennison, if I ever have a child, I will name my child after you. And my first child is named Melissa Dennison Arneson Trunzo. Her middle name is Dennison. So that's how much I revere the United States Post Office. And with that, let me not only introduce you, Alexandra. She has an amazing bio, and I could go on forever, but she covers education, consumer affairs, healthcare, tech, and data sciences. She's won all kinds of awards. She serves on the board of directors for the Chicago Journalists Association. I could go on, but I want her to explain to you exactly what's in this story and why it should make you basically apoplectic. The title of the piece, Letter Carriers Face Bullets and Beatings While Postal Service Sidelines Police. And Alexandra, I didn't know the post office had police. And then after reading your piece, it turns out that a lot of agencies have police. I mean, how naive am I? But the story you tell about the vulnerability of postal workers is not only both shocking, but to some extent predictable. And then of course, the one thing we do know about the US Post Office is that there's universal hatred for a fellow named DeJoy. So as soon as I write the word post office, I mean, immediately people start screaming, what are they going to replace him? What are they going to replace him? But then as you read this story, I'm taking my shovel because all the crap that comes out of his mouth in defense of what he's doing, when you hear what he spins in these press releases, you think, oh, all right, he's aware, he's doing something. And then what you do in your story is you give us the historical piece where you see what we were doing in 1992, you see what we were doing before, and you realize that what he is doing literally nothing. But of course, if you have no history, you have no understanding that he's basically giving you BS. Not only do I want to welcome you to the program, but I guess I need to figure this out. Who turned you on to this story? Are you married to someone in the Postal Service? I'm just sort of curious, because not only is it remarkable, but you have so much information that really provides not only an insight into the history of the Post Office, but why we're so dedicated to it as a society. Everyone thinks that Amazon's going to replace them or they're going to be privatized by this. But it turns out that no matter where you live, in urban America or rural America, the post office is actually very, very important.
Absolutely. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me back, Arnie. I think that what you saw on Facebook totally reflects what so many people are feeling, just outrage about this issue. I mean, everyone gets the mail. Everyone, you know, most people love their local mailman, mail lady. And to hear that they are being attacked, you know, not infrequently is just insane to people. So this story came about, you know, had a postal employee reach out to us at Raw Story based on an investigation we did about mail theft. So actually Representative Ken Calvert in California, he had nearly $10,000 stolen from his campaign from the mail. So an active member of Congress experienced this firsthand in a significant amount of money. And so, so a postal employee reached out and kind of gave all this incredible detail about what exactly is going on with this police office, this police force, and the attacks on letter carriers. That really piqued our interest.
So I'm glad that they reached out. I'm glad a member of Congress, it's only when a member of Congress loses a family in a shooting, then they suddenly have like a come to Jesus moment. It's only when a member of Congress loses money that's going to go into his campaign that they have a come to Jesus moment. You kind of get a little ticked off at that, but you know, I'll take it anyway. I get it. Not only did he talk about this postal worker, talk about the thefts and the beatings, but he connected the dots to something that wasn't just about the fact that they're feeling more vulnerable. It's that they feel like in some ways they're being intentionally more vulnerable because there were things that have been done in the past that are not being done today. And as a result of that, not only are they more frightened, but they're more angry because they know that there were more protections in place in the past and there are fewer protections today. So explain to us not only just the rise in this kind of physical abuse and the theft, but that we understood that these guys were always vulnerable and that they needed to be protected. And there's a history of that. And of course, now with the joy in place, they're draining money out of the system. They're doing everything to make the Postal Service even more vulnerable. But when you look at the physicality of this story, you get really angry.
Exactly. So one of the most striking figures, and these are buried in government reports that no one's looking at, but just over the course of 3 years, letter carrier robberies rose by 543%. So just a massive spike. And this is happening at the exact same time that back in 2020, DeJoy and the Postal Inspection Service essentially benched their postal police force. So the postal police came about in the 1970s, recognizing that letter carriers are targeted by criminals for theft of packages, checks, cash, you know, all sorts of valuable information in the mail, people's personal information that can be sold on the black market. So the rise in crime happened at the exact time that the postal police, which used to be out on the streets, they'd sit on a corner in a high crime area, look out for the letter carriers. They could escort them. They were in marked cars. They're in uniform. They have guns. If they saw a robbery happening, they could stop it. And now they're essentially relegated to just being in post office buildings. So they can only be in a post office, in a distribution center. If something happened on the sidewalk outside, fine, they can intervene. But if they're driving, you know, between facilities and they see a robbery happening on the street, they're told, don't do anything. Call 911 instead. You're an armed police officer, but this is out of your jurisdiction now. Leave it up to the local police.
And I'm just going to read from your piece again, because again, I want to reinforce the numbers, because the numbers are powerful. And the numbers really reinforce with an exclamation point every single sentence in your piece, Alexandria, which is phenomenal. Because of a 2020 statute reinterpretation from the Postal Service, its own dwindling uniform police force of 450 officers no longer patrol streets where letter carriers like Norris delivers the mail. Now, 450, we're talking for the country. For the country, everyone. 450. I could do 450 in New Hampshire, okay? But we're talking about a nation, okay? From Hawaii to Alaska. And then I read, instead, postal police officers whose numbers exceeded 2,600 in the 1970s are now relegated to only working on postal properties such as neighborhood post offices and regional distribution centers. So I just want to remind everyone that 1970s was like like 54 years ago. Okay. And that was, the population was how much less 54 years ago? And they had 2,600. So now understand, even the 450 is a joke, because if they're only relegated to post offices and regional distribution centers, there are more than 450 post offices in New York, let alone in the United States. So again, when you hear these numbers, until you put them into context, you know, basically, there are no postal police. There are none. You can claim there are. You can say 450 locations. You can give us a number, but the number has no meaning when you look at how far and vast they have to cover. And that means, in essence, they don't exist. But yet, for whatever reason, we've seen a spike in abuse to postal workers. And let me think of something else, Alexandra. You had a postal worker reach out to you. And what I'm thinking is, so I'm thinking of my Amazon guy that drops stuff off all the time, not because I order from Amazon, but the kids that live with me do. They come up in a truck, they get out of their truck, they drop it off on the porch, and then they leave. Okay, and they take a picture, yada, yada, yada. Now I'm thinking of my postman. My postman walks up and down the street in rain and snow and sleet. He doesn't have a car to jump into. He doesn't have a car to jump out of. Everybody knows he's rude. Everybody can follow him. They especially know that maybe at Christmas he's carrying packages. Oh, a good time to rob. Or they may know that they're coming to my house and maybe I'm a politician and, oh, maybe, you know, there'll be money dropped off at my office. So in a lot of ways, they are the essence of vulnerability. They almost have a target on their back. On their back. So as we're doing this story and we're seeing this rise in crime, what is DeJoy claiming he is doing to make the situation safer? Because all I know is that they're shutting down offices and they're taking away my drop boxes. And I don't see safe, I see less. But I'm just kind of curious, as they're doing the less, are they taking that money and making their postal workers safer, or are they just making less of less?
Letter carriers are being targeted for, which I had never heard of this term before, arrow keys. So they're essentially the universal keys that open communal post, communal mailboxes and apartments, and the blue boxes that you see on your corners. So that's why they're being targeted. And DeJoy says he's come up with this initiative called Project Safe Delivery. And he says, we're going to modernize those keys. Those are antiquated. Once you get one of those keys, you can access all sorts of packages and letters and personal information, cash, et cetera. So that's great. But he has said the goal is by the end of this year to replace about 50,000 of these keys. But there are 9 million. So that is less than 1%. So, you know, great for, you know, in theory, but they say, I believe it was more than $2.5 billion is what it would cost to replace all just the hardware of all of these keys. So the post office says it's too much. You know, that if we can't make a plan to get these all fixed right away, that'll take forever and be too much money, but we're going to get a start. So he's doing that. The Postal Inspection Service, which is the law enforcement arm of the post office, they've increased the rewards that they offer for when someone is attacked. And hey, if you have a tip, please help us get these solved, bring justice. But from what I could tell in my research, that those rewards weren't paid out very often. People weren't, you know, people, these criminals are smart. You know, they wear masks, they attack people in areas that, you know, maybe they don't have a lot of cameras. They know the routes, like you said, and they can get away with it pretty easily.
I'm going to go again to your piece. Again, the numbers. When you tell me about those keys, I want to throw up. I'm just like, in a way, I almost don't want you to be on the air telling me that story, that they use the same damn key for all those boxes. I'm like, whoa, just nab one post guy and you got every box in the state available to you. I mean, this is, it's evil, everyone. It's evil. We know that we have these infrastructure bills, okay? And we're talking about fixing roads and bridges. Let me just remind you, everyone, the Postal Service is infrastructure. It's a form of infrastructure. It's especially a form of infrastructure if you live in rural America. It's especially a form of infrastructure if you don't have access to the internet. It's especially a form of infrastructure if you need it because that's how you get your check, your social security check, whatever. So to hear what he's doing to improve the boxes, by the way, most of them they're taken away anyway, is shocking when you told me they need 9 million of them and they've only delivered 50,000 of them. I mean, it's the numbers are so depressing. And I know that you're talking about at the end of your piece about the fact that they're putting in some pieces of legislation to begin to protect it. But I guess I have a question for you. As Joe Biden was doing his infrastructure bill, Was there any way for them to look at the post office and its needs as a form of infrastructure? Because I think we need to do a parallel track. I just don't want to have more access to the internet. I want to have more access to a very safe post office, which frankly, right about now, the only thing that's safe and keeps your privacy is a stamp. Putting it on the internet is making you hackable. Putting it in an envelope with a stamp makes you more protected. But obviously, that may be its problem because it is actually something that has a higher standard, except if you could rob and beat up and open all the boxes. So what are members of Congress doing in response not only to the numbers that you discovered, not only to the fact that we all already despise DeJoy, but that what he ultimately suggests as a way of, responding to the needs turns out to be a joke? I mean, it just reinforces that he doesn't really care about the post office. He just wants to sort of, gloss it over to create the illusion of doing something when, in effect, he's doing very little.
The members of Congress, there are a few bills out there right now. So there's the Postal Police Reform Act, both a House and a Senate version. There's the Protect Our Letter Carriers Act that was just introduced about a week ago. And all the members of Congress I spoke with, so many of them have reached out to DeJoy, written letters. We're shocked by these numbers. And most of them have told me they feel like, DeJoy has completely ignored them. And so these bills, I mean, they're considered pretty common sense. Essentially, let's use these postal police officers, even if there's only 450 of them. They helped deter crime historically. Let's get them out there. We're seeing this spike. So that's the biggest part of these bills. And then they do say the modernization efforts are great. Let's do more. So that's kind of where we're at right now. As we know with our current Congress, not a lot has gotten passed in recent times. So, the hope is certainly that the bills would get passed, but at this point, it's kind of hard to tell if they will.
Alexandra, remind my audience again about the relationship between the government and the post office, because it's not exactly your normal agency. And I think that that's part of the problem. And for example, how DeJoy gets chosen isn't necessarily by the president. So I need to like refresh everyone's recollection because I feel like it's almost like the bastard child. It's called the United States Postal Service, but actually it's not as United States as you would think. Yes, it covers all 50 states, but it has a very, very bizarre relationship with the federal government. And so therefore the support that it needs, the money that it needs, the infrastructure improvement that it needs becomes almost impossible because of the way it sort of is required to sort of self-fund itself. So explain to my audience a little bit about the post office because I think that really needs to be readdressed. Not just putting the 450, which is a joke on a street. I mean, you could even pass a bill like that is embarrassing. But more importantly, I think we need to sort of refresh our recollection about the post office. And I am a person who believes that we should be creating post office banks. There are so many places in this country that are unbanked. We know post offices are everywhere. Why not provide a place where vulnerable people and rural people and old people can go? And guess where they could go? To a post office. So there's a lot of reasons to protect the post office. We do very little to do that.
Yes, the Postal Service, I mean, we all benefit from it, right? They're serving everybody in the country. And like you said, it certainly is a part of infrastructure for this country. And it has the unique experience of everyone is literally affected by the Postal Service, where bridges are important and but they affect people mostly in a certain area. And so so the Postmaster General is appointed or nominated rather by the president, but the Postal Service, as you said, they get they have its own funding structure. There's been constant restructuring and cuts to the Postal Service. So they just have all sorts of initiatives that they are responsible for. So, and but they have to work in tandem with other agencies. So, for instance, mail theft, the Postal Inspection Service is in charge of investigating these things, but also they need to rope in the FBI on some levels. And there's just a lot of disjointed interagency components to how the Postal Service works. And they often are facing the restructuring and the lack of funds to serve the entire country.
If you do any harm to a postal worker, that's a federal offense. And I don't think people quite understand that that is in part its relationship. I was listening to TV this morning, and they were talking about the problems with social media, the problems with vulnerability, the problems with hacking, the problems with all this. And I've become a new supporter of the concept of what is old is new again. And so one of my responses to what is old is new again, Alexandra, is that I believe that we should be using billboards as opposed to be using the internet, okay? Because you have to avert your eyes, okay? And everybody at some point in time walks down a street or like gets in their car or is on a train. And guess what? On a billboard, you get to tell the story. And I'm going back to the post office again. There's another aspect to the post office that I want people to remember. It's a physical human being. It's someone that has a route. It's someone that knows you. It's someone that notices, for example, that you haven't picked your mail up in a week. And when they've noticed that they haven't picked a mail up in a week, it is not uncommon for someone to say someone needs to go in there and check because they notice that maybe someone's not alive anymore, or someone is sick, or they know your damn dog. The mail off at my house in rural Orford, New Hampshire, knew and loved my dog and would literally like make sure he always had cookies and candies for the dog. There is a human relationship here that is so lacking in America. And the one of the biggest complaints I think we all have, Alexandra, is that we don't trust anyone anymore. And what I think was so remarkable about your story and the response that people were giving to your story was not only their anger and frustration with DeJoy, but their anger and frustration with the dismantling of the Postal Service, because they really do see it as the one thing the government actually can do, provide a human being to serve you. And I think if there's a frustration now with people's mental illness, with people's feeling of loneliness, and it turns out that the Postal Service serves another form of social glue. And therefore, to hear that they're being abused and beaten and we're doing little to help them is both shocking, but that level of immorality, it does need a champion, because in a lot of ways there are champion. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got so upset as I was reading your piece, because we understood it in the past. And I'm just going to tell you, Amazon hasn't replaced them. And there's one other thing. So you know that there's a big push to vote by mail. Another reason why there's an assault on the post office, another reason why there's an assault on the mail, is because it turns out that it's probably one of the most effective ways to exercise the franchise. So how do we explain to members of Congress? This isn't just about you losing $10,000, Mr. Congressman. It may be about the fact that you don't get elected. So, did that come up at all during the course of your conversations?
Yes. So the timing of the statute reinterpretation, of course, was summer 2020. So that certainly was an optics component of this, right? With all of the false claims about election fraud and people voting by mail illegally, that is potentially a part of the motivation behind this statute reinterpretation, from what I was hearing from some sources. So, again, as you said, this is just a really, I think, a human story where people used to have respect and care for their letter carriers who are caring for them and providing a service 6 days a
They
week.
are. They
All,
are.
so yeah, so it, it is, objectively a sad and shocking situation that letter carriers are doing this job. They're federal employees and they don't feel safe out there. As my one source I spoke with said, she feels like she's in survival mode, and she is relying on her neighbors, that her customers, to essentially look out for her because she doesn't have the protection out there from the government, which could provide it.
And you know, it's interesting. One of the things that they talk about too with vote by mail is they're also talking about the drop boxes. And so it's not necessarily vote by mail, but they put these drop boxes right next to the post box. Well, if you start lifting up all the post boxes and getting rid of them, then where do you put the drop boxes? So again, I mean, they're distracting you in so many ways. And I mean, I'm not saying that it's distraction by the assault on the postal workers, but what I am saying is there is a long-term agenda here. And the long-term agenda isn't just about serving the public with the post office. But if it turns out that's a way that you can exercise the franchise, be safe, be anywhere, know your vote will be counted, not have to worry about taking time off from work in order to vote and stand online for 9 hours. I mean, think about all the things it does. It is so vital and so valuable now more than ever. Then explain this. Then explain this. Alexandra Jacobson is an investigative reporter at Raw Story. She's been there since 2023. She's an extensive track record of social justice, education, consumer affairs, healthcare, tech, and data sciences. She's a multimedia journalist, and she also serves on the board of directors for the Chicago Journalists Association. Please do me a favor, read her piece about letter carriers. Letter carriers face bullets and beatings. It's at Raw Story. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And I hope we can find someone who can go to the mat for them, because it's not just about delivering the mail. It's about delivering trust. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. This, everyone, is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You bet.